Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, the 10 things people get wrong about streaming part one. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Andy.
This week, we're going to deviate a little bit from our normal format. We are not going to be taking a look back at the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week, although it was a week when big and interesting music industry news stories happened. So let's just acknowledge one of those up front, and that was that the IFPI finally released its stats for the global recorded music market in 2019.
Yes, every year the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry puts out a report that basically gathers all of the stats that have been published by the record industries in not every single country in the world, but most countries in the world. So in every single market, a trade body, or a collecting society, or a chart compiler, or some combination of the three, put out stats about how much money was made by the record industry through all the different revenue streams, selling CDs, selling vinyl, download streams, sync, public performance, broadcast, all those different revenue streams. Each country puts out its stats. But then what the IFPI does, and it's very useful, we're very appreciative that they do this, is they then gather all that together, crunch it, so that A, we get some global figures, and B, it makes it easier to compare what's going on market to market. And so this is a report they bring out every spring. This year, the original plan was to actually bring it out a little bit earlier than normal. It was meant to be coming out in March, and usually when they bring it out, they have an event in London where lots of journalists and industry people are invited. Usually on stage, there'll be Francis Moore, the CEO of IFPI, but then a representative of each of the three majors, and usually one of the big indies will be there as well. And they all talk about the report. And usually what happens is the label people all say how brilliantly the record industry is doing and it's all wonderful. And then at the end, Francis, because ultimately the IFPI is a lobbying organization, will do the, oh, but it could be better. Bloody piracy, bloody safe harbors, bloody. She doesn't say bloody. She says fucking safe harbors. No, she doesn't. She's much more polite than that. But she then gives sort of the lobbying wish list. And that's usually what happens. But that didn't happen this year. The whole thing got postponed. There was no big launch event because, of course, of the COVID-19 shutdown. So they sort of just quietly published the report last week. But some interesting stats in there. I mean, the trends we already knew, but it's always good to have those trends confirmed and some actual figures to back it up. So, for example, what those figures told us was that there was a 22.9% increase in streaming revenues last year worldwide. So that's all the different streaming services combined. So from the YouTubes and TikToks over here through to the premium Spotify and Apple Musics over here. That helped compensate for continued declines in CD sales and in download income, so that the record industry at large saw increases of 8.2% in revenue, which translates to $20.2 billion American dollars in hard cash. So that was the sort of the big figures in there. The other stats that we kind of knew this already, but we now have a more precise figure for, is that as of last year, streaming became more than half of the global record industry. So streaming has been the fastest growing revenue stream for quite some time. Streaming has been the biggest revenue stream for quite some time. But what happened last year is that streaming on a worldwide basis started to account for more than half of all recorded music revenue streams. So 56.1% of the record industry's income in 2019 came from streaming. And then a majority of that is from premium streaming. So Spotify and Apple Music, the paid for services, and then some of it is coming in from the free services, Spotify Free, YouTube, etc. So some interesting stats, but also interesting in the context of a debate that has been happening online since the COVID-19 shutdown began. And the fact that that debate has started to happen, this is a debate amongst artists and songwriters, but a vocal debate that everyone is watching and tuning into. The fact that that debate has been happening since COVID shutdown began was probably another reason why the IFPI and the major record companies didn't want to have a big event where they talked about how brilliant everything is and the fact all this money's coming in on streaming. They probably would rather not have that conversation in the context of COVID-19 and also in the context of this debate that's ongoing within the artist and songwriter community.
Yes. So this debate is not a new one. It's about the issues around the revenue from streaming and how it gets divided up among the various stakeholders. However, Since the beginning of the COVID-19 lockdown, where artists have basically seen their live income disappear, they've now got a lot of time to really focus on what it is they're earning from streaming. And a lot of them are finding that they're not that happy with what they're getting at the moment. And so there's been a lot of talk about this. A lot of artists have been talking about this on social media. There have been a lot of articles written about it. There've been a lot of podcast interviews about it. It's been a big talking point that's grown and grown and grown. And like you say, possibly, although I think there were other reasons that the IFPI didn't go really big on their announcement this year, that may well have contributed to the reasons for wanting to be a bit more low key about things.
Yes, it might seem inappropriate anyway to have the labels talking about just how well everything is going in the context of the COVID-19 shutdown and the fact that so many people within the music community and well beyond are struggling. But also, yeah, the other side of that is if the labels talk about how well they're doing because of streaming, those artists who feel that they're not seeing the value of that might say, well, hang on a second, if you're doing so well, why don't we get a bigger cut of that money? So, I mean, among the artists who have been very vocal on this, I mean, obviously in the US, you have people like David Lowery who are always vocal on this. So that's not new for them, but they're continuing to contribute to the debate. Here in the UK, Tom Gray from Gomez has become increasingly vocal on this in recent months, and actually was talking about this on his social platforms even before the COVID-19 shutdown began, but has sort of been rallying more support from other artists since shutdown did begin. Tim Burgess from The Charlatans joined in the conversation last week. And then in terms of people commenting on it, yes, there's been quite a few articles on this. Stuart Dredge at Music Ally wrote a really interesting response to some of the things that have been discussed. Annabella Koldrick, CEO of the Music Managers Forum, put an opinion piece up on Medium. And so there've been lots of interesting stuff out there. So we thought, well, maybe we should dedicate an edition of Setlist to discussing this debate ourselves because, well, we have some opinions on this debate, but also I think some insights and some information. Because when you look at what everybody is saying, the artists and then the fans join in on the socials as well, and then the journalists and the people who comment, some of what they say is right, but some of what they say is actually misunderstanding how it works. And some people get things predominantly right and some people get things predominantly wrong. But I think even in those conversations, which are sort of moving in the right direction, sometimes things are said where it's like, yeah, that's not quite how it works. And I sort of think it's not that we really have an agenda either way. I've been researching this and writing about this for so long now, and I've spoken to so many people about this over the last 5 years. I often find myself very much sitting on the fence because I fully understand every argument on every side. And sometimes I find it hard to decide which argument to side with. But there are sometimes things people say which are wrong. And I think, you know, if you are an artist and songwriter and you want to be part of this and you want to try and bring about change, it's important that you get everything right, because the minute you start getting things wrong, it gives the other side ammunition to say, oh, well, what you're talking about is a load of nonsense, so therefore we don't have to engage with you. So we thought we might spend this edition of Setlist talking through some of the complexities of the way streaming works and the way the money gets shared out to help people better understand. And I've been doing all these CMU lockdown webinars in recent weeks. Andy Mulder's not tuned into any. Apparently he knows everything. He doesn't need to listen.
You sent me a link and I might watch one sometime. I've been busy.
They've been going very well. I mean, we've had people tuning in from all over the world, so we don't care that Andy Malt's not tuning in. But what you...
I've been trying to educate children who are not interested in the intricacies of the music industry just yet.
Well, you can never start too early, I would say.
I think it might be a little bit above their level.
But had you done one of CMU's lockdown webinars, and thank you to everybody who listens to the podcast who's been tuning into those. If you haven't, they're out there. We've got a whole load more coming up. You should sign up. But most of those webinars are basically 10-step guides to whatever the topic is. So if I'm talking about sync, or I'm talking about streaming, or I'm talking about record deals, or I'm talking about marketing, I do it in 10 steps. So therefore, when I sat down to think about all the things that we should say about the streaming business model and how the money gets shared out and what artists, songwriters need to know in order to have an informed opinion and to participate in this debate, without even thinking about it, I automatically came up with 10 key points.
Yeah, so we're going to go through all 10 one by one, although we're going to split them into two parts. So we'll do 5 this week and 5 next week. And we're going to start with something that comes up in a lot of articles and discussion around this. And the thing people are getting wrong is that there are no per stream rates.
Yeah, everyone's obsessed about the per stream rate. Every time your track streams on Spotify or Apple or Amazon, what do you earn? And at least twice a year, a little JPEG just around on the social networks, which seems to be a rate card that says every time your track gets streamed on Spotify, you earn this. Every time your track gets streamed on Apple, you get paid this. And then all the other services are in there. And then usually then people do some maths and they say, okay, how much would 1 million streams make? How many streams do you need to make minimum wage? How many streams do you need to make in order to have enough money to live off on the month, etc., etc.? But that is very misleading because, yeah, as you say, there are no per stream rates because the streaming business is a revenue share based on consumption share setup.
So revenue share based on consumption share, that sounds quite complicated. What do you mean by that?
What do I mean by that? Good question. Okay, so this is...
Thanks.
...is a little bit complicated. But basically what happens is at the end of every month, what a service like Spotify does is it takes each track on the platform and it doesn't say how many times was that track played. It says of all the streams that were serviced in any one month, so each individual stream, what percentage were of that single track. And obviously, because there are so many tracks available on streaming services, for each track, we're talking about 0.00000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000 any one track. I don't know. Maybe a Drake track will be 62%. I don't know. The Weeknd, probably 14%. But, you know, for most tracks, it will be a really, really, really small percentage of overall consumption. But that's how we begin. Okay, what percentage of overall consumption was accounted for by this track? The next question the service would then ask is, okay, how much money did we make last month? How much cash came in? Then what they do is they say, okay, of all of that money, if this track accounted for 0.0001% of listening, we would allocate that percentage of the money to that track. So we now have an allocation to the track, a chunk of money allocated to the track. So let's say that ends up being £1,000. So we've got £1,000 allocated to the track. It doesn't matter how many times the track was listened to. What matters is, of all the consumption overall, what percentage came from this track. So now we've allocated £1,000, dollars, euros, whatever, to the track. That's when the revenue share bit kicks in. So then we say, okay, well, which record company or music distributor provided us with this track? Universal. Okay, so we have a revenue share deal with Universal that says that any money allocated to one of their tracks, they get 55% of the money. So we're going to give 55% of that allocation, that'll be £550, to Universal. But that's just the recording rights. Within the recording, there's also a song, and somebody else will control the copyright in the songs, and we need to pay them too. So we then say, okay, well, who do we deal with on the song side? Now, that in itself is a complex question to answer, but more about that later. So they'll say, okay, that publisher controls the song. We have a revenue share deal with that publisher. That publisher gets 15% of the allocated money. So we'll now allocate 15% of the money to the publisher. So we've now got the recording paid for and the song paid for. And then whatever's left on the table, Spotify gets to keep. And that is what is happening with each track each month. Then the label or distributor will share the money it receives with the artist, subject to contract, whatever the contract between the artist and the label says, and the publisher, or it might be a collecting society on the song side, will share that money with the songwriter, subject to their contract and their agreements. And that is what is happening every month. Now, obviously, once all of that has happened, as a label or an artist, you could then say, well, we received £550 for that track. We know that track was streamed X times over the month. So we're going to divide £550 by X. And out of that, we get a per play rate. And when you see that rate card doing the rounds, in essence, that is what has happened, is that somebody has got a set of streaming data around a certain catalogue of music, and they've done that maths. They know how much money came in any one month. They know how many times the track was streamed. They do some maths and they say, okay, this is the per play rate. But crucially, the per play rate was not there at the start. That's something that we can do in hindsight. There's also another thing that's misleading about that rate card that does the rounds. And that's because this maths that is done every month, where the service says, okay, what percentage of overall consumption was this track? And therefore, take that percentage, allocation, rev share, all of that. That process is done separately for each of the products that each streaming service offers. So if we take Spotify, so Spotify will do the maths for the paid for version and then the free version. And then usually all the other iterations as well separately. So the student discount, the family plan, the mobile bundle, all of those are added up differently. So for each of those services, the money is set aside, the consumption data is reviewed, and then the maths is done. And the reason why that is important is that Spotify has a free version and Apple doesn't. And what you'll notice on those rate cards is that they don't split the services up by product. They just say Spotify, Apple, Amazon. And that is why on that JPEG that does the rounds, it always looks like Apple Music pays significantly more than Spotify, like more than double. And that's because Apple doesn't have the free version. The Spotify rate is what we would call a blended rate. It's all the different versions of Spotify merged together and you get an average out the other end. But what you would earn on a free stream is vastly less than what you would earn on a paid for stream, like 10 times less. So then when you average it out, that's why it looks like Spotify's rate is so much lower than Apple's rate. Actually, a Spotify premium and an Apple premium stream are probably pretty similar. Apple probably is playing slightly more, but only slightly more, not double more. So that's another reason why those figures are misleading. And then the last thing to say on this point is the figures are also processed separately for every country. And obviously, even if we just look at the premium side of streaming, where people are paying the standard rate with no discounting going on, what the average rate is per month varies from country to country, because in a lot of emerging markets, you couldn't charge the equivalent of £10, €10, $10. Because if you did, it would make it a premium product and very few people would be able to sign up. So they're paying the economic equivalent of $10, which is possibly $3 a month. And because it's revenue share, if the subscribers are paying less, then obviously, once we average all out, the money you're getting for each stream is going to be less as well. And those figures don't show you any geographical variation or indeed explain, are these figures just for streams in the US? So they're just with US subscription rates? Or are they the streams of US artists and songwriters and labels and publishers, but for streams that happened all over the world? Because if a lot of your fan base are in Latin America or parts of Asia, then you're going to be getting less money per stream because there's less revenue to be shared out when they do the revenue share. So although that list that does the rounds gives you a very approximate indication of what per play rates may be once everything is averaged out, certainly in markets like the UK and the US. But there is lots of approximation going on there, and there's various things about those lists which are misleading. It is definitely true that once you average it out, the payments per stream are tiny, fractions of a penny, fractions of a cent, and even more so if it's a free service. That is definitely true. But the way that rate card is often used and talked about is very misleading. So that is point number one.
So moving on to point two, as you said, people often take those rate cards and they multiply it out to work out different things, like, as you said, how many streams you need to get to make minimum wage, or quite commonly, how much a million streams would get you in revenue. So point number two is a million streams isn't as many as it sounds.
Yeah, when people multiply up the figures and say, oh my God, a million streams would only make you X. So for the premium services in the UK, a million streams probably is bringing in somewhere between £4,000 and £5,000 across the rights, split between the recording rights and the song rights. It used to be slightly higher. It may be getting that it's slightly lower, but around about that for a million premium streams in the UK. And obviously for the free services, a lot less, and for emerging markets, a lot less. And I think what people are saying is, I got a million streams. That's so many streams. Can you believe that you're only making this relatively small sum of money? Now, don't get me wrong. Getting a million streams is not easy. You know, there are lots of artists putting their music out there through DIY distributors. And the thought of getting a million streams is kind of a distant dream. But that said, you also have to remember that when we talk about a million streams, we are talking about it in the context of billions and billions and billions and billions of streams being serviced across the different platforms every single day of the week. You know, there's a lot of streams to be grabbed as an artist. And I think we all struggle with big numbers, don't we? We always struggle to sort of picture what a million is. But for example, if you've got 10,000 fans who are following you on Spotify, and each of those 10,000 fans, when they tune into Spotify each day, for however many hours they're streaming, they listen to three or four of your tracks during that daily listening time, that's a million streams over the month. So that's 10,000 fans on one service listening to your music three or four times a day. There's your million streams. So I, in some ways, the question is, can you get 10,000 fans on Spotify who are listening to your music three or four times a day? That's ultimately what we're aiming for. And as I say, definitely acknowledge that, you know, finding 10,000 fans who will stream your music on a regular basis, that is a challenge. But it's also worth acknowledging that there are plenty of artists out there, and I'm not just talking about the superstar artists. There are middle-level artists who have a few million fans connected to them on Spotify. So there are artists for whom this model definitely works. They have a few million fans on Spotify. Those fans, a significant portion of them, are streaming several of their tracks, certainly in a month, and sometimes every day. And you know, getting up to a million, 2 million, 3 million is actually quite achievable. So we're not saying that there aren't challenges here. We're not saying that there aren't issues with the model. But I think the whole million streams things is sometimes a bit misleading because people struggle with big numbers. And therefore, a million streams sort of sounds like a much bigger deal than it really is.
Okay, on to point three. Now, one of the various things that people have said during this kind of growing debate around streaming income is that services like Spotify should just increase the amount of money they give to artists. But to do that, because as you say, it's a revenue share agreement, the way to do that is to put up the prices they charge consumers, which, I mean, Spotify has been around for a decade now and has never increased its prices, which if you think about the number of times Netflix has increased its prices in the last 2 or 3 years, it's a bit odd. And maybe, I mean, obviously Spotify started with a higher price point, so maybe that's an issue. And it has all these other things, like you said, the student discount, the various different offers that you can get to pay less initially to get people up to that £10 a month in the end, hopefully. But maybe we have reached a point where the £10 a month is no longer the goal price point. However, right now may not be the point in time to start pushing up prices.
Yeah, had we been having this conversation 6 months ago, I think I would have been saying, yeah, I think it is time now that that sort of base price, that £10 a month price, and obviously a lot of people get it discounted from that, emerging markets, it's the equivalent of that rather than the direct currency conversion of that. Of course, Amazon and Tidal, and in some markets, Deezer have tried to also go above the £10 a month by offering the higher audio quality at a premium. But if we say the sort of the base price is £10, $10, 10 euros, it does feel like that should be increased at some point in the relatively near future, which would mean that more money was coming in. Spotify has experimented with increasing the price point in a couple of Scandinavian markets. But there's two things to say about those Scandinavian markets. First of all, they're incredibly mature streaming markets where probably it's fair to say anyone who is going to pay to stream in those countries is almost certainly already paying to stream. So it's not like with quite a lot of the emerging markets and even some of the European markets where Spotify is still trying to sign up new people who've never paid to stream before. Also, the Scandinavian countries where they have done it are countries where the currency is krona, not euro. And I think one of the problems of Spotify is by picking 9.99 way back when they first began, whether that's 9.99 pounds, euros or dollars, that's a really hard price point to then play with, because going from $9.99 to $10.99 somehow seems a bigger deal than what Netflix did, which is they went from $5.99 to $6.99. So had they started with a less precise round figure price point, then I think increasing prices would have been easier. And as I say, in the two Scandinavian markets where they've experimented with this, because it's krona, it's a weird figure to start with. So although they would have to email everybody to tell them the prices were going up, I suspect most people wouldn't read the email and wouldn't even notice on their bank statements that the price had gone up. I suppose the other challenge for Spotify on price point, which is another reason why music is different to Netflix type services, is that Spotify and Amazon and Apple all basically have the same catalogue of music. Okay, there's a few exclusive sessions that each of the services have. On the podcast side, they have some exclusive content. Tidal and Apple dabbled with getting exclusive rights to certain albums. But in the main, they have the same 50, 55 million tracks Whereas obviously Netflix and Amazon Prime and Now and the new Disney service all have complementary content. So there is some content that you can only get on some of those services. So it makes it, in theory, easier for a Spotify user to switch over to Apple if suddenly Spotify put its prices up and Apple didn't. And Apple is in a position where it could not put its prices up, even if ultimately that meant Apple taking a hit, because the record companies started to say to Apple, well, Spotify put their prices up, so we need to be getting more money from you too. Apple might say, well, we'll just take a smaller revenue share. We'll go below the 30% that the streaming services generally try to keep hold of, because Apple could afford to do that if it gave them a class advantage over Spotify, who are now charging $10.99 a month. So there are some challenges with getting the subscription rates up. That said, I do think we're probably getting to the point where we have to go from $9.99 to $10.99, say, because, I mean, you know, the world has moved on. There's been quite a lot of inflation since the late 2000s. It does sort of seem a bit mad that that hasn't happened yet. And I certainly think some people would simply say, well, Spotify should take less than 30%. The streaming services who have generally tried to hold on to at least 30% of the money. Actually, in Spotify's case, if anything, they're trying to get that up a little bit. Well, they should take less. And that these streaming services, they have plush offices in big cities and they have loads and loads of staff. We don't really understand what those staff do. And the senior executives are paid incredibly well. And there are investors at the top who are starting to take a profit off. They should take a smaller cut. But I personally believe that that's not a viable option. You know, there is a reason why the model was that the service got to keep at least 30%. And I think that, from my opinion, is fair. But in terms of getting more money from the streaming services into the music industry, increasing the price is another way of doing that. And I personally think that that is something that should be seriously looked into, and that the record industry and the publishers and the artists and songwriters should be part of that debate. How do we make that happen? Except in the middle of the COVID-19 shutdown, when so many people are under pressure financially and looking to make savings, I don't think in the current climate is the time to be saying, oh, we're going to add another pound a month onto your Spotify bill. And if you did, it would be bad PR and it might see you lose more people than you would at another time. So I think it's definitely something that should be talked about, but probably something that might happen in a year, 18 months time, rather than now. That said, it's probably going to take that long to work out how you might go about doing this in a way that wouldn't screw up what has already been built or give an Apple a huge competitive advantage over everybody else.
Yeah, so if we assume that there's not going to be more money coming into the streaming business through price rises, I mean, obviously there will be more money coming in because there are more people signing up to these streaming services all the time at the moment, and that creates more money in that industry. But then we need to look at how we start to redistribute the money that is coming in to be fairer to everyone involved in creating that music.
Yeah, what we like to call the digital pie debate. So if we assume that the base rate is going to remain for at least the next year, £10, €10, $10, if we assume that the streaming services are going to continue to keep around about 30% of that money, what happens to the 70% of the money that enters the music industry? And at the start, when we were talking about the revenue share by consumption share thing, I talked about the rev share, and I said that when we're doing all that maths, probably on the recording side, Universal Music, say, would be getting about 55% of the money allocated to its music, whereas a publisher, including Universal Music Publishing, would be probably getting something more around about 15%. So that the approximate revenue share brackets, every deal is different. But generally speaking, somewhere between 50 and 60% of money gets allocated to recordings, and somewhere between 10 and 15% gets allocated to songs. So you will immediately notice, even if you're terrible at maths, that a lot more is going to the recording than the song. It could be four times more, it could be five times more, it could be as much as six times more going to the recording than the song. Now, needless to say, there are a lot of songwriters and publishers who work with songwriters who think that that's not fair, that the recording is getting so much more than the song. It's probably worth quickly explaining why that even was set up that way. Why did we end up with the recording getting so much more than the song? And it's because when digital music first came along, initially the iTunes store and downloading, when it was decided how the money would get shared out between the recording rights and the song rights, basically we began with the CD model. How the money gets shared out when a compact disc is sold. And it was always the case in the music industry that when physical product was sold, vinyl, cassette, CD, etc., that the vast majority of the money went to the record company. So that the money allocated to the publishers for the songs that were contained on those discs would always be a really small slice of the pie, usually a single figure percent. It did vary from country to country. In most countries, that publishing money, what we would call the mechanical royalty money, usually flowed through the collective licensing system, and therefore there would be industry standard rates and everyone would pay the same percentage. So in the UK, on an MCPS license, it was 8.5% of wholesale, but that equates to something like 6.5% of retail. And the percentage figures we talk about in terms of streaming are retail percentages. So retail is more important than wholesale. So the song was getting around about 6.5% of the money on a CD. Why? Well, the argument always was the record company does an awful lot of work and takes a phenomenal risk making the recording, pressing up the CD, getting those CDs into record shops, doing all of the marketing around the CD. Then when the CD doesn't sell, having to get all the CDs back in and destroy them, the record company spends a lot of money, it takes a lot of risk, it does a lot of work. Meanwhile, the publisher kind of just sits in their office watching all that happen and then takes a percentage of the money. So the argument was it's fair for the label to take the vast majority of the money. Whereas with something like radio, where recordings of songs get played on the radio and then the radio stations pay money to the music industry through the collective licensing system, because with radio, really, neither side of the industry is doing any more work than the other. I mean, you could argue, actually, it's the record company's PR machine that gets music played on the radio to start with. But generally with radio, it's more of a 50-50 split. It's not quite that simple because generally the record companies and the publishers and the artists and songwriters get paid separately through their own collecting societies. But it will be something like a 50-50 split on radio. When iTunes came along, the record industry proposed that we take the CD model for downloads rather than the radio model because it felt like downloads were the digital version of selling CDs. Quite early on in the digital revolution, the publishers and the songwriters and their collecting societies said, that doesn't seem right that you're going to get the same on a download that you got on a CD because there's a lot less risk with downloads. You're not having to press up any discs or get those discs to market. So after a lot of squabbling, in the main, the publishers got a slight increase on a download as compared to a disc. Then streaming came along and the record industry said, well, we've set digital in place now. We should take what we have for downloads. We should apply it to Spotify. And again, the publishers said, well, actually, it feels like it's even easier for you in the streaming space than the download space. We should get more. And slowly but surely, the rate has increased so that on a stream, the money allocated to the song is as much as double what would have been allocated in percentage terms on a CD. And that has come about through various different things happening. However, there were plenty of songwriters and publishers who would say, okay, there may have been a slight reslicing of the pie, but it's not enough. We should be getting significantly more. Some would go as far as to say, okay, maybe iTunes was the digital version of a record shop and selling discs. Maybe Spotify is the digital version of radio. It's kind of like a radio experience, but with more interactivity. So actually, we shouldn't be starting with the CD model and then giving the publishers slightly more. We should be starting with the radio 50-50 model and then maybe cutting a little bit off the publishers to recognise the labels are doing more work. So this is one of the ongoing debates, and in the conversations I've been having on the social networks in recent weeks, this is something that people are talking about, that we need another more significant reslicing of the pie. One thing that's being thrown out there, the Ivors Academy that represents songwriters here in the UK is very vocal on this, is maybe of the money that comes into the music industry, it should be that a third is allocated to the song and two-thirds to the recording, which would see the publishers and songwriters getting a not insignificant uplift and the labels and the artists they work with taking a hit.
Which brings us to point number four, which is that reslicing the pie so songwriters get more is complicated.
Yeah, I sort of alluded to that when I was explaining that there has been this slight reslicing of the pie since digital began and over the last 10, 15 years. The reason why reslicing the pie to the benefit of songwriters and publishers is tricky is because in digital, songs and recordings are licensed separately. So whereas with a disc, when a record company puts out a CD, the record company is the licensee on the song side. So the record company sends a CD to a record shop, the record shop sells it, the record shop sends the money back to the label, usually through a distributor. The record shop doesn't have any relationship with the publisher. The record shop doesn't even need to know what a publisher is. The record shop almost certainly does not know what a music publisher is. The money comes back to the label, and then that's the label's responsibility to have a license in place for the song and to pay a portion of that money over to the publisher and the songwriters, usually through the collective licensing system. However, in the main, with digital, the publishers and their collecting societies license the streaming services, not the labels. So we have two separate sets of deal making going on. The labels and distributors negotiate their deals for the recordings, and the publishers and the collecting societies negotiate their deals for the songs. So when, as what happened at some point in the last decade, Sony ATV, for example, biggest music publisher in the world, starts to say to Spotify, we're not happy with our rate. We want another 3%. We want to go from 12% to 15%. Spotify will say, well, we've been clear from the start that we need 30% for this to be a viable business. We've already allocated 58% to the labels. So where's this other 3% coming from? The only way that we could give you, Sony ATV, 3% more is if we could persuade Sony Music, the Sony record company, to take 3% less. And in essence, that started to happen, that the publishers were pushing their rates up, and Spotify ultimately persuaded, albeit with some extra goodies thrown in to sweeten the deal, the labels to come down slightly. But there is no forum where everybody can go, artists, labels, songwriters and publishers, and just say, OK, of the money coming in, how should we slice it up? Because the two sides of the industry are negotiating their deals separately. So it's really tricky to achieve. There's also one last thing to say on this, which is if you think about the big music rights companies, Sony, Universal, Warner and the bigger independents as well. If you've got big music rights companies that are both record labels and publishers, and most of them are, if you are one of those companies, just because of the way the music industry works, on a record deal, the label usually, not always, but usually gets to keep most of the money. On a publishing deal, the songwriter gets most of the money. That's just the way those deals are set up. So actually, if you're a big music rights company that has both a label and a publishing division, you would like all the money to come in through the label and none of it to come in through the publishing company. If you're the person sitting at the top. So that's one of the challenges, is the big music rights companies are unlikely to take the lead, even though they have big interests in publishing, on this debate. And it's a tricky one to fix because the two sides of the business license separately, which isn't to say that there should not be a campaign on this, and that maybe the way to do this is almost through a PR campaign backed by artists and songwriters, bearing in mind that those people who are both artists and songwriters are both winners and losers in that, because, you know, if the recording money goes down, then the artist's money will go down too, to the benefit of the songwriter. So there probably should be a campaign on this, but it's just understanding that getting that reslicing of the pie is quite complicated to achieve.
And of course, point number five, the US is different because the US is always different.
Yeah, when it comes to what the songwriters get paid, there's a big added complication in America, which is that copyright law interferes, because copyright law frequently interferes in America when it comes to what money gets allocated to the song. Without getting into this in any too great a detail, we have a compulsory license when it comes to mechanical rights. And then on the performing rights side, although there isn't a compulsory license, because of the consent decrees that regulate BMI and ASCAP, there might as well be a compulsory license. A stream actually exploits the two sides of the copyright, both mechanical rights and performing rights, but both sides of the song copyright are constrained by law in America, which adds extra complexities. And obviously, we've been reporting on this quite a lot in the CMU Daily. Ultimately, it all comes down to a panel of three judges to decide what the song is due. It's called the Copyright Royalty Board. They did actually decide to increase the rate in the last time that they looked at it. The streaming services, with the notable exception of Apple, are disputing that increase. They would argue because of technicalities in the way the compulsory license for mechanicals works, rather than the principle of there being an increase in general. That's all going through the motions. It's proving very controversial. But even if the rate increase that the CRB set in place does go ahead, and whatever the technicalities are that are causing problems with compulsory license, I mean, for definite, at the very least, that increase up to 15% under the compulsory license in the US should definitely happen. But I mean, we should acknowledge that would only bring the song rights in America up to where they pretty much already are in Europe. So actually, that CRB thing isn't fixing this bigger problem. It's simply bringing the US up to speed with the rest of the world. But it is worth acknowledging that whenever it comes to this sort of stuff in America, because copyright law interferes, That adds extra complexities. I think for those people in America, it's remembering that some of the issues that you have in America are unique to America because of American copyright law. And actually, I mean, personally, I would be arguing that there shouldn't be a compulsory license covering streaming. So it may well be that what needs to happen in America is some further reform of copyright law, even though that Music Modernization Act we had a couple of years ago was meant to be a once-in-a-generation overhaul. But there are still some weird things about American copyright law which add extra complexities to all of this.
Yes, so it's all quite complicated and made all the more complicated by America, as is always the case with anything copyright-related. But if your head is currently swimming with all this, we have reached the end of part one of this two-part episode, so you can go and have a little lie down. I think I might do that. Before next week, we get on to five more things people get wrong about streaming. And if you want to receive that second part of this episode, it will be out next Monday, and you can just mash that subscribe button right now to get it delivered automatically to whatever podcast app you happen to be using. But that is all we've got time for this week. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.